This afternoon, we want to discuss the speculations and laboratory experiments that are related to theories on the origin of life. Now, if there is one subject related to origins that is outside of the scientific domain, it is certainly the origin of life. You see, there's just, as far as the origin of plants and animals are concerned, there is some fossil evidence to consider. There is some historical evidence related to the origin of plants and animals. But when it comes to the origin of life, of course, there's absolutely no historical evidence whatsoever. For the molecules that are postulated to have arisen under primitive earth conditions, of course, would have been ingested and utilized by the living forms that arose as a result of the origin of life. They would have long ago have been destroyed. Absolutely no historical evidence available. And, of course, we can't go in the laboratory and recapitulate the origin of life. So, as far as the origin of life is concerned, scientists will be forever speculating how life may have evolved, but no one will ever know scientifically how life really did arise on this planet. Certainly the answer is beyond any scientific study. But, of course, man has always speculated about origins, and today we find very considerable great deal of speculations and laboratory experiments related to these speculations on the origin of life. You read about this stuff in all of your high school biology books and college biology books, and anything on the origins or on evolution will include a section on the origin of life. NASA, in their publications, have stated that one of the major objectives of our space program is to investigate the origin of life. They're hoping to find some primitive forms of life somewhere in the solar system, or at least some chemicals that will give them some idea about the origin of life. We are flatly predicting, by the way, that when the Viking, our unmanned spacecraft, reaches the surface of Mars, and we trust that it will be a successful soft landing and the investigation will be successful, we are flatly predicting that they'll find absolutely no trace of any living organisms there or any organic material. We are predicting that the rocks on Mars will be as clean as those that were found on the moon. And one laboratory did the analysis on the moon rock, said that they had never analyzed any material as clean as that brought back from the moon. Well, in the old days, many decades ago, people used to suggest that life just spontaneously came into being, that there was a fortuitous arrangement of matter such that life just in an instant came into being. Well, scientists finally realized that the probability for such an event was zero. But they are still speculating that life arose spontaneously, only instead of suggesting that life came about in an instant, they are suggesting that the chemicals necessary for the origin of life and the resultant systems evolved or arose through hundreds of millions of years of time. It was a slow, progressive process. That is, most evolutionists are suggesting this sort of an idea. And they have initiated a number of laboratory experiments in support or in pursuant of these ideas. We're going to review those suggestions today and to give you a solid scientific basis for rejecting all of these speculations. We are absolutely convinced that there is enough knowledge concerning the chemical kinetics and thermodynamics and other natural processes to tell us absolutely that the origin of life by a strictly mechanistic naturalistic process would not only have had a vanishingly, well, a very small probability, but it would have had a vanishingly small probability. It would have been absolutely impossible for life to have arisen under any naturally occurring conditions or processes. Now, we're going to consider the origin of life in several phases. We may... Would somebody switch on the projector, please? People who speculate on the origin of life must consider this problem in several phases. First of all, we must attempt to reconstruct what the primitive Earth must have been like. Those who are suggesting that life arose on this planet by some mechanistic process must try to reconstruct what the primordial Earth was like. The gases, for instance, that made up its atmosphere, the temperature and the pH of the oceans, what energy sources were available, what chemicals may have been around. This must be imagined. And I say imagined because we have no historical record of what actually occurred then, and we can't go back in time to test these conditions, so we must try to imagine what these conditions were like. But that would be the first requisite, a primitive Earth model. Then after we have imagined what the primitive Earth may have been like, we must try to imagine under these assumed conditions, first of all, how relatively simple compounds may have arisen. And we must have an ocean full of these compounds. We must have tremendous quantities. So the procedures or processes which generated these compounds must have been highly efficient. You see, the ocean contains 350 million cubic miles of water. 350 million cubic miles of water. So if there was a chemical in that ocean that existed in a significant concentration, it would have required many, many billions of tons of that material. So each chemical that contributed to the origin of life then had to exist by the billions and billions of tons. Now, after we have the Earth populated with the concentrations of these relatively simple compounds, we must try to imagine how they became associated or combined in the large and complex macromolecules, such as the proteins, the DNA and the RNA, carbohydrates, and other large and complex molecules. Then after we have the ocean swarming with these large molecules, the proteins, the DNA, and so forth, we must try to imagine how they became associated in the systems. Because life, you see, consists of systems whereby we have cooperative processes involving many protein molecules of the DNA and the RNA. Life consists of highly coordinated systems, systems that are coordinated in time and space. And so out of this vast swarm of randomly arranged molecules, we must try to imagine how highly organized systems arose that were, of course, metabolically active. They did something, and they did something purposeful. And then finally, we must try to imagine how the final state arose, an organization that was completely independent, self-maintaining, self-replicating unit, which would be the first cell. We're going to consider this problem then, going through these various stages. Of course, we're going to have to do this briefly. We cannot devote nearly the amount of time that we ought to each one of these phases. First of all, let's consider the type of atmosphere we might have had on the primordial Earth. Now, at the present time, we have an oxidizing atmosphere. Our present atmosphere is what we call an oxidizing atmosphere. It is called an oxidizing atmosphere because it contains free oxygen. The present atmosphere has about 78% nitrogen and 21% oxygen. That's 99%, leaving 1% of argon and carbon dioxide and water vapor and other minor amounts of various other gases. Our atmosphere is an oxidizing atmosphere because of the presence of this free oxygen. As you know, iron will spontaneously rust to form iron oxide and flammable material when it is subjected to high enough temperature will spontaneously burst into flame and will become oxidized. So we have at present an oxidizing atmosphere. Now it was realized after some time by origin of life speculators that life could not have arisen in the type of an atmosphere that we have today. This is so because the oxygen would have spontaneously oxidized everything. All the carbon would have been converted to carbon dioxide. If there were any ammonia present, it would have been converted to nitrogen and water. Everything would have been burned up, so to speak. And there would have been nothing left for the origin of life. Amino acids would spontaneously be oxidized to carbon dioxide and water and nitrogen and so forth. Carbohydrates would be destroyed if they were present. And so it would have been thermodynamically impossible for life to arise in the presence of oxygen. So, presto, it was immediately decided then that the Earth did not have an oxidizing atmosphere. Initially, it must have had a reducing atmosphere. These people who believe so strongly in uniformitarianism, that is, the present is the key to the past, readily abandoned this concept when faced with an impossible situation. Life could not have evolved in the presence of free oxygen, so they immediately assumed that the primitive Earth had no free oxygen. Now, this is an assumption. There is much evidence against such an assumption. Let us say, first of all, there is no evidence, or practically no evidence, for the idea that the Earth ever had an atmosphere different than the one that we have today, and there is much evidence against it. I do not have time to discuss the basis for that statement. You will find that in my monograph on the origin of life. But there is much evidence that the Earth has always had an oxidizing atmosphere, and if it did, then the origin of life would have been impossible. And I think there is much evidence then that right from the very start, the origin of life would have been impossible, because from the very start, even assuming that this Earth arose somehow 5 billion years or so ago, that there would have been a significant quantity of oxygen in the atmosphere from the very start, or nearly from the very start, which would have prevented the accumulation of organic compounds and thus the origin of life. But let us assume now, as evolutionists do, that the Earth truly did have a reducing atmosphere, that instead of carbon dioxide, that the carbon was in the form of either carbon monoxide or in the form of methane. And nitrogen, rather than being present as free nitrogen, it was present in the form of not only free nitrogen, but some ammonia. And that there was free hydrogen in the atmosphere rather than free oxygen. There was no free oxygen, but rather free hydrogen. And then, of course, there was water vapor. This is the type of atmosphere that has been assumed by most of these origin of life speculators. Now, some have asserted, one of these being Dr. Philip Abelson, the editor of Science and director of Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C., some have asserted that the Earth never did have a methane ammonia atmosphere. Dr. Abelson has published a paper in which he has asserted that there's not only no evidence the Earth ever had a methane ammonia atmosphere, but there is much evidence against it. But Dr. Abelson, being an evolutionist, like all other evolutionists, he must assume at least that the Earth had a reducing atmosphere in the beginning, that there was no free oxygen. Some, like Dr. Abelson, have suggested that carbon existed in the form of carbon monoxide, although he believed there was no methane present and no ammonia. At least there was free hydrogen and no free oxygen. All right, let's assume then at least that the Earth did have some sort of a reducing atmosphere. There was no oxygen present. Now, under these assumed conditions then, with these simple gases present, such as water vapor, nitrogen, carbon monoxide or methane and perhaps some ammonia and hydrogen, is it possible under these conditions that the chemicals that would have been the required constituents for the origin of more complex chemicals that led to life, under these conditions, could these simple chemicals arise spontaneously? Now, the textbooks that we find in our colleges and our high schools all indicate that these chemicals could have arisen spontaneously, that it has been demonstrated in the laboratory that it is possible. Well, let's take a look now at one of these famous experiments, the experiment of Dr. Stanley Miller, that supposedly demonstrated that these simple organic compounds would arise spontaneously under these assumed plausible Earth conditions. Here's, first of all, before we look at that experiment, let's consider some of the types of compounds that must have arisen. One required compound, of course, were the amino acids, since amino acids are the building blocks or the subunits of proteins. Proteins consist of polymers or long chains which are made up of amino acids. Amino acids are joined one to another to form the proteins. You notice the amino acid has a carboxyl group on one end and amino group on the other. The amino group, under certain special conditions, which we can use in the laboratory or which our body has available or living things have available, the amino group combines with the carboxyl group of another amino acid, splitting out water during this chemical reaction and forms a bond between the amino group of one amino acid and the carboxyl group of the other. And then on that same amino acid, its carboxyl group in turn can form a bond with the amino group of another amino acid. We might illustrate it in this manner. I could ask several of you people to come down to the front of the auditorium and then to join hands. Since you have two hands, you see, you could join hands with the person on the right and the one on the left. And he could, in turn, do the same thing. And therefore, you could form these long chains. Well, amino acids are the same. And all the subunits in these large macromolecules have two reacting groups, and so they can form these polymers or long chains. So if we're going to have proteins, then we must have an ocean populated with these amino acids. Now, in present-day proteins, we find 20 different kinds of amino acids. Of course, if we assume that these arose by chemical evolution, many, many more besides 20 amino acids could come about. But in proteins, we find only 20 amino acids. But in the under chemical evolution or in the laboratory, we could make hundreds of different kinds of amino acids. Now, in addition to amino acids, we must have the constituents that go into the DNA and the RNA. The subunits of the DNA and the RNA, and we'll see a picture of these shortly, are made up of three different kinds of chemicals. Each subunit or nucleotide in the DNA and RNA consists of either a pyrimidine or a purine and a sugar and phosphoric acid. So, if these RNA and DNA subunits arose spontaneously, then that primitive ocean had to be populated with these purines and pyrimidines and had to have a lot of phosphoric acid and sugar presence, you see. So, then the origin of life chemist must attempt to reconstruct how amino acids and purines, pyrimidines, and sugars and so forth could have arisen spontaneously under these assumed conditions. Now, let us take a look at this famous experiment of Stanley Miller, published in 1953, and which supposedly demonstrated that life could have arisen spontaneously. Dr. Miller assumed that the atmosphere consisted of ammonia, nitrogen, water vapor, and hydrogen, among other gases. So he placed these gases in his apparatus, and then he, of course, had to supply an energy source. Dr. Miller, in this case, provided an electrical discharge. as the energy source. This simulates electrical discharges that might have occurred in the primitive atmosphere. Now, most of the energy available on the primitive Earth would have been supplied by ultraviolet light from the sun. But some could have been provided by electrical discharge. And the particular source of energy is immaterial. Some source of energy must be provided. In this case, it was electrical discharge. So Dr. Miller then filled his apparatus with these gases, which he circulated through the electrical discharge. The electrical discharge providing the energy, which provided the energy for combining the simple gases into the more complex compound. Now, you notice in the apparatus he has a trap down here at the bottom, and the water vapor, of course, was condensed by the condenser here, collected in the trap along with the products of the reaction. Dr. Miller circulated these gases for about 2 weeks, collecting the product in the trap. Now, the moment a minute quantity of product was formed, it was immediately isolated in the trap. The gases, of course, continued to circulate. After about a week or so, Dr. Miller analyzed the material in the trap, and lo and behold, he detected the presence of several amino acids in addition to some simple acids and other compounds which are found in living things. On the announcement of these results, the whole scientific world went wild and declared that Dr. Miller had established a plausible basis for speculating that life had arisen spontaneously on the primitive Earth by demonstrating the spontaneous formation of these chemicals which form the subunits of the more complex chemicals found in living things. Now, first of all, concerning this experiment and other similar experiments, we want to point out that the results are really trivial. Dr. Miller successfully, using the conditions of this experiment, produced some very simple compounds. But these compounds are very simple indeed. They merely form the building blocks or the subunits of proteins. We might compare them to bricks in their relationship to a building. Now, the fact that you have a pile of bricks does not in any way indicate that you could build a building. The bricks must be arranged, of course, in a highly specific way. They must be cemented with mortar and so forth. And in addition to the bricks, you must have the timbers and the girders and the other masonry that's necessary and the electrical lines and plumbing and everything else that goes into a building before you can have a building. And the simple amino acids are infinitely far removed from the complexity of a living cell. So what he accomplished, first of all, was very trivial. Secondly, what he accomplished could never have been possible without the imposition of some artificial conditions which would never have existed on the primitive Earth. And that was the presence of the trap in his apparatus. Without the trap, Dr. Miller would have obtained no detectable quantity of product. Now, Dr. Miller is a smart organic chemist, and he realized that if he's going to accumulate any detectable quantity of product, he had to trap out the product, isolate it from the energy source, because the energy that is necessary for the formation of these compounds is far more efficient in their destruction than in their formation. The rate of destruction of these compounds by electrical discharge, by ultraviolet light, or by any other such source of raw energy, the rate of destruction of these compounds would far, far exceed the rate of formation. And if you take into account not only the rate of formation, but also the rate of destruction, and calculate the equilibrium point, you will find that you have no significant quantity of product. You cannot accumulate any significant, even detectable quantity of product by this means. And this is what would prevent the very origin of life, is the fact that any source of energy that you may use would so rapidly and efficiently destroy the product that you'd never be able to accumulate any significant quantity of product. Supposedly, this material forms in the atmosphere. The half time of fallout is about 3 years. If you form a pound of this stuff in the atmosphere, it takes 3 years for half of it to reach the ocean. And then another 3 years, of course, for half of the half. By the time it reaches the surface of the ocean, all of it, or practically all of it, has already been destroyed. Dr. D.E. Hull, in an article published in Nature in 1960, which was 7 years after the publication of Miller's paper, pointed out the fact that even the simplest amino acid, which is glycine, it contains only two carbons. It is therefore the stablest of all amino acids, the most efficiently formed, and it is the most resistant to destruction. Yet, even this simple amino acid, 97% of it would be destroyed before it reached the ocean. And after it reached the ocean, because of the fact that ultraviolet light does penetrate to at least 10 meters or so of the ocean, and there's constant mixing, the fact that there are other energy sources available to destroy glycine, that the equilibrium concentration of glycine in the primitive ocean could have been no higher than about 10 to the minus 20th molar. Now that's essentially infinite dilution. Minus 10 to the minus 20th molar would be far too small to have any significant effect on any origin of life schemes. Now glycine is the simplest, therefore the stablest, and most easily formed. But consider now glucose, a sugar which has six carbon atoms. It is much more complex than glycine, therefore it is much more difficult to form, but it's much more easy to destroy. Dr. Hull calculated the equilibrium concentration of glucose would have been 10 to the minus 134th molar. Now that concentration is so low that if the entire universe was one great big chemical reaction or chemical solution, the chances are overwhelming you couldn't find one single molecule in the entire universe. What Dr. Hull demonstrated is by considering now the chemical kinetics, thermodynamics, that common knowledge, he demonstrated that there could be no significant quantity of these materials accumulating under any of these so-called plausible Earth conditions. Dr. Hull's conclusion is found, here I wanted to illustrate the so-called primitive Earth conditions under which these compounds were formed, you see, which demonstrate there were no trap. We have the compounds, the simple gases being irradiated by ultraviolet light or by electrical discharges, forming these compounds in the air which drifted down to the ocean. And while they were drifting down, of course, they were being zapped by the electrical discharge or destroyed by the ultraviolet light and other sources. There's no trap here. The ocean itself is not a trap. Most of the compounds would be destroyed before they reach the ocean, but the ocean itself is not a trap. During a debate at San Diego State involving Dr. Morse and myself and two other evolutionists, the subject of the origin of life came up. Dr. Stanley Miller happened to be in the audience, so one of the evolutionists suggested that Dr. Miller would like to come to the platform and make a few statements. And so he did, and he suggested during one of his statements that the ocean would have provided a trap. Well, in my rebuttal, I just mentioned the fact that in the book authored by Dr. Miller and Dr. Leslie Orgel, that they had admitted, in effect, that the ocean was no trap, because they said that if the ocean had a temperature as high as 25 degrees centigrade, which is a little higher than room temperature, that the rate of destruction of all these compounds would be so high there'd be absolutely no chance for life evolving. And they suggested that a temperature of 0 degrees, which is the freezing point, would be better, and that a temperature of minus 21 degrees would be much better. Well, at minus 21 degrees, everything would be frozen solid. The ocean would be one mammoth block of ice. And so I just mentioned that whatever happened in that huge block of ice, one thing is certain, life would never evolve. You get down at that temperature, of course, there's no energy available. And so Dr. Miller, in his own book, in effect, admitted that the ocean was no trap. And indeed, it would not be. You see, as a matter of fact, even if you did have a trap, even if you were able to have minute quantities of these products formed, which were continually being trapped out, isolated from any energy, that's the end of the line. You're not going to go anywhere. You're not going to go any further. Because, you see, to combine the amino acids to form proteins, or the sugars and the phosphoric acid, and the pyrimidines and purines to form the DNA and RNA, you've got to have energy. Without the energy, you're not going anywhere. You have to have energy. And the minute that the energy is introduced, the energy then would destroy these products much, much, much more rapidly than they would incorporate them into the more complex compound. So ultimately, the origin of life chemist faces an insolvable dilemma. He has to have energy, but the energy is too destructive. You see, in our bodies or in the laboratory, we utilize highly specific forms of energy, and we use highly specific conditions whereby we can encourage the formation of these chemical bonds with a minimal destruction of the starting materials. And of course, we carefully control our conditions. We may heat the reaction for a very limited time, and we may introduce the energy in the form of some very high energy compounds and so forth. And our bodies, of course, have highly sophisticated machines to do this with. If you have these highly controlled conditions, it is possible to build up complex compounds and minimize the destruction of the starting material. But if you're dependent upon raw, uncontrolled energy, such as ultraviolet light, heat, or any other such source of energy, that energy is so highly destructive, you'll never get the specific syntheses that you require. You'd merely destroy anything that was present. And that is one thing that would totally prevent the origin of life, if there was nothing else, is the fact that energy, any form of energy available, would be so highly destructive of any product that you had never accumulated any quantity of these materials. It led Dr. Hull to make the following statement. Dr. Hull said that the physical chemist, guided by the proved principles of chemical thermodynamics and kinetics, cannot offer any encouragement to the biochemist who needs an ocean full of these organic compounds to form even lifeless coacervates. The coacervate is merely a blob of material that precipitates out of a solution at a certain concentration without any organization or specificity. Even to form these lifeless blobs, you'd need an ocean full of these organic compounds. Now notice that Dr. Hull said, now not based upon any speculation, not based upon what he hopes may have happened or what he thinks must have happened, Dr. Hull says, guided by the proved principles of thermodynamics and kinetics, we cannot offer any encouragement to these origin of life chemists. So we can say then, based upon proved principles, well known in science, but completely ignored by these origin of life chemists, that the origin of life would have been impossible by any mechanistic, naturalistic process right here at this very primitive stage. And as we will see, as we move up the ladder, the difficulties do not double. They increase exponentially as we go from one stage to the other. Now, not only this fact, would it prevent the origin of life, but there are other problems. Dr. Philip Abelson, in his 1966 article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, also pointed out the fact that amino acids spontaneously react with sugars to mutually destroy one another. The amino group of the amino acid combines with the aldehyde or keto group of the sugar to form a bond, chemical bond, which destroys the amino acid and the sugar. They neither one are of any further use for the origin of any biologically active compounds. It is assumed by these people that the supply of amino acids would have exceeded the supply of sugars. So, this means that all sugar would have been destroyed. There'd be no sugar left. There'd be a little bit of amino acids left after this spontaneous reaction. But there would be no sugar left. That means no sugar, no RNA, DNA, carbohydrate. No RNA, DNA, no carbohydrates, no life, you see. Now, one chemist goes into his laboratory and runs an experiment, demonstrates how he thinks amino acids came about, and everybody rejoices. Another chemist goes in another laboratory, sets up different conditions, and generates sugars. And then everybody rejoices and says, well, we've got that problem solved. Forgetting that all of this had to take place in one great big reaction media, in other words, the ocean or lake or whatever we're thinking about. And if you have sugars and amino acids all together in the same pot, they are going to destroy one another. And therefore, we could have no possibility of life evolving. Now, another factor is that the phosphoric acid, if present in the ocean, would have been precipitated in the form of insoluble salt by any calcium that would have been present. Calcium forms an insoluble salt with phosphoric acid. And there's a large excess of calcium over the quantity of phosphoric acid that would have been present. So all the phosphoric acid would have been precipitated in the form of an insoluble calcium salt. No phosphoric acid, no ATP, no nucleotides of any kind, and no DNA and no RNA. And so we see that there are many reasons why the origin of life would have been chemically impossible based upon known natural laws and natural processes, even at this very simple stage. Well, in spite of all this, let us assume that somehow the ocean became populated with amino acids and sugars. Somehow they stood off from one another and didn't react. And somehow the calcium didn't precipitate all the phosphoric acid, just didn't do it, didn't do things chemically. Like it ought to. Let us assume the ocean got populated with all these kinds of chemicals. Now we have come to a much more difficult phase of the problem, the combination of these relatively simple compounds into the complex compounds. For example, the amino acids, of course, had to combine one with another to form the long chains. We call these bonds peptide bonds between the amino acid, or the amino group of one amino acid, and the carboxyl group of the other. It must combine, splitting out water and forming a peptide bond. And you would have hundreds of these peptide bonds in a protein, because proteins consist usually of several hundred amino acids, one joined to the other. Now, the first problem we want to consider is the actual formation of the chemical bond, ignoring for the present the particular or specific arrangement of the amino acids that would be required. Let us consider the problem involved in the formation of the chemical bond itself. Now, the problem is this. To form those chemical bonds requires the input of energy. You've got to put energy in to form those chemical bonds. Therefore, this does not occur spontaneously. What occurs spontaneously is the rupture of those bonds, releasing the energy. If you dump a bunch of proteins and amino acids in a bucket of water, sterilize the whole, and let it stand around for a million years and come back then and analyze the product, you'll find that all of the proteins have spontaneously broken down, releasing the amino acids. And the amino acids themselves, of course, would have spontaneously deteriorated or degenerated to more simple compounds. You would not spontaneously form any protein at all. It's like driving an automobile uphill. As long as you have an energy source, as long as you have the gasoline, as long as you have the engine for utilizing the energy, you can drive the automobile uphill. But if you run out of gas or you kill the engine, the car is going to run spontaneously. It's going to run right back down the bottom of the hill. And that's what happens with these compounds. They spontaneously break up to release a simpler compound, but they'd never spontaneously form. We'd have the same problem in the formation of the DNA and the RNA. Here we have a short segment of a DNA molecule, we have the sugar combined with the phosphoric acid. And you see the backbone of the DNA of the RNA consists of repeating units of the sugar, phosphoric acid, sugar, phosphoric acid, sugar, phosphoric acid, and so forth and so on. Well, there's no information there. The information in the RNA and the DNA is due to the specific arrangement of the bases or the pyrimidines and purines. Here in this short section of a DNA molecule, we have thymine, then guanine, then cytosine, and then adenine. And it's the specific arrangement or sequence of these purines and pyrimidines that spells out the genetic language. But first of all, you must form the chemical bond between the, in this case, the pyrimidine thymine and the sugar, and between the sugar and phosphoric acid. You must form these chemical bonds. Now, again, they do not form spontaneously because it requires the input of energy, but they do spontaneously break apart. Now, we want to talk about, well, the problem could be visualized in this way. The polymers you see spontaneously break apart to release the monomers. The proteins will break apart to release amino acids. The DNA and the RNA will release the pyrimidine, purine, sugars, and phosphoric acid spontaneously. There is practically no tendency, and we could say essentially no tendency, for the monomers to spontaneously form the polymer. Now, some ideas have been suggested for overcoming this thermodynamic barrier. Well, the barrier is there, but it must be overcome. I'm going to talk about just one idea, and that is the idea of Sidney Fox. Sidney Fox has become world famous for his suggestion. He has published his material in practically all of the major scientific journals. It is found in practically every textbook on biology and evolution at the high school and the college level. Dr. Fox has been invited all over the world. Nobel Prize winners go in and out of his laboratory frequently, I have been told, as they visit his laboratory. He had a book dedicated to him on the occasion of his 60th birthday. So Dr. Fox has become world famous for his suggestions, while at the same time being as generous as possible. We could characterize his suggestions as nothing more than pseudoscience. The worst kind of pseudoscience that's ever been published, I believe, in the history of science, are those which incorporate Dr. Fox's ideas. Now, this is what Dr. Fox did. He went in the laboratory, and I don't know why he did it. He went in the laboratory, and in a test tube or an apparatus, he placed a mixture of pure, dry amino acids. There are no sugars present, no simple acids present, no simple amines, no ketones, aldehydes, nothing of any kind. All of these marvelous organic molecules, which supposedly arose spontaneously by chemical evolution on the earth, somehow were missing. And in his apparatus, he put a mixture of pure amino acids, nothing else, and they were dry. He found that he could have no moisture present, no water present. It had to be dry. So in this apparatus, then, he placed this mixture of amino acids, and by trial and error, he found if he heated this mixture at about 175 degrees centigrade, and that's 75 degrees higher than the boiling point of water. Water boils, of course, at 100 degrees centigrade. So one thing is certain, wherever it happened, it didn't happen in the primitive ocean. It would have boiled off all the water. So he heated this mixture at 175 degrees for about 6 hours. He found, again, by trial and error, at less than 6 hours, he didn't get much product. If he heated much beyond 6 hours, he completely destroyed the product that was formed. So he found then by trial and error, if he heated this at 175 degrees for 6 hours, then removed his source of heat, added some water, again heated it to about the boiling point of water and stirred it up, and then he filtered off or got rid of all the junk that was present, leaving this hot aqueous solution of his product. He allowed that to cool down. Little globules formed. The product in this hot solution precipitated out, forming these little globules that he called microspheres. When Dr. Fox analyzed materials in the microspheres, he found that it contained polymers of amino acids. This brutal temperature of 175 degrees had forced those amino acids to combine, splitting out water. No water was present, you see, to repress the reaction. The water was able to vaporize out, and he formed the polymers of these amino acids. Now, they weren't nearly as long as those found in protein, but they were, at least they were polymers. And Dr. Fox, by this experiment, has claimed that he has practically created life. The globules resemble bacteria, he says, and he claims some actual enzymatic activities for the products, and he claims it has order and just about everything which would constitute a protocell, or the precursor to the cell. And he's become world famous for these claims that we have mentioned. Now let me give you a few reasons why this scheme could have absolutely nothing to do with any supposed origin of life. And there are many reasons. First of all, where would you find a temperature of 175 degrees on the so-called primitive Earth? Well, Dr. Fox suggested that all of this reaction happened around the edges of volcanoes, So now all this amino acid that formed in the atmosphere and floated down the surface of the Earth, that didn't work. Everything that just floated down the surface of the ocean, that didn't work, and that's about 70% of the surface of the ocean. Only that material that floated down out of the atmosphere and just settled around the edges of these volcanoes, that worked. Everything else didn't work. Now, another thing, it had to sit there for about 6 hours. If it would stay there for a few days or a few weeks or a few months, it'd just be destroyed. And it had to sit there for about 6 hours. It wasn't long enough. So when asked about this, Dr. Fox suggested this stuff settled down out of the atmosphere, down the edge of a volcano, sit there about 6 hours, and then it rained and washed it off in the ocean. So you had to generate billions and billions of tons of proteins by these very highly circumscribed conditions. Well, that's totally impossible. As a matter of fact, Orgel and Miller, in their book on the origin of life, published in 1974, they asked the question, where on the Earth could you find the temperature of 175 degrees where you could drop a package of amino acids and get some polymerization? They concluded that there wasn't a single such place on the entire surface of our globe. Because even around the edge of a volcano, if the lava has solidified, the temperature of that lava at the surface is hardly any higher than air temperature. You've got to go down a foot or two beneath the surface of the lava to find that high temperature. There's no place, there's not a single place on the surface of the Earth to provide these conditions. Well, that's the least difficulty with the problem. The greatest problem is this. Dr. Fox placed nothing but pure amino acids in his reaction mixture. Now, let's ask ourselves a question. Where in the world could you find a pure mixture of amino acids plus nothing? Where on this earth could you find such a mixture, or could you have found such a mixture? There is only one place conceivable. And that's the laboratory of a 20th century scientist. Never on the primitive Earth could you have had such a mixture. Because while all this chemical evolution is going on, of course, if it did go on, as they postulate, you'd have all kinds of sugars and ketones and aldehydes and simple acids and simple amines and everything else being generated too. So wherever you had any chemicals, you'd have a mixture of all these chemicals. And one thing is certain, if you mix that all together and heat it up, one thing is certain, you wouldn't get any polymer of amino acid. You'd get nothing but junk. Now, you see, his idea is absolutely, totally implausible because he had to have a mixture of pure amino acids. And absolutely, there's not the slightest possibility that any such thing could ever occur. Had to be pure, had to be dry, you'd never get such a situation. And he found out that he had to have a high proportion of either glutamic acid, aspartic acid, or lysine. Or it wouldn't work. You just couldn't take any old mixture of amino acids and heat them up. That wouldn't work. You had to have a high proportion of either one of the acidic amino acids or the basic amino acid lysine. Only then would the experiment succeed. And in all of these origin of life experiments where they're generating amino acids, and none of them do you get a high proportion of glutamic acid or aspartic acid, and you get no lysine. You get a high proportion of glycine, and of alanine, which are the simplest amino acids, as you would expect. You have to have a totally unreal proportion of these amino acids. And there's other objections. But I think this is enough to totally rule out Dr. Fox's idea. It's absolutely impossible. And yet that man is world famous for his suggestions, found everywhere. Absolutely, totally unworkable. And I find in talking to other people in The Origin of Life, they have no better opinion of his work than I do. The people who are really knowledgeable realize this. But yet he is famous because of the bias that we find in this area. Well, that is one of the suggestions. And there are others, but none are really better than that. But you can consult the monograph on this subject for discussion of these other suggestions. We see no way, absolutely no way, that these polymers could have formed spontaneously because of the fact you have to pour energy in and the energy would destroy the compounds rather than spontaneously forming the product. But now, supposing there was some way to form the polymers, supposing there was some way to form those chemical bonds. Well, we've only scratched the surface of the difficulty. We've now come into the real problem, an insuperable problem, and that is the fact that these subunits must be arranged in a highly specific order to form biologically active compounds. For example, in the protein, we have a highly specific arrangement of the amino acids. In the nucleotide, we have a high specific arrangement or order found in these compounds. In the RNA molecule, this transfer RNA, there is a highly precise arrangement of the nucleotides in the compound. These letters here represent the different kinds of nucleotides. And in this particular transfer RNA, there are about 77 of those nucleotides arranged in a highly precise order. In tobacco mosaic virus, which we studied when I was on the staff of the virus laboratory at Berkeley, we found that tobacco mosaic virus, which is the simplest plant virus known, has 6,600 nucleotides arranged in a highly precise order. The genes in living things have hundreds to thousands of these units arranged in highly precise order. In the proteins, we find the same order must be present. Here is the human growth hormone molecule, which consists of 188 amino acids, 20 different kinds, arranged in highly precise order. Coming first is phenylalanine, and then proline, threonine, isoleucine, proline, leucine, serine, arginine, leucine, phenylalanine, so forth, around to 188 of these amino acids. And you must have that order before you have biological activity. Now, here's the problem. If you give a monkey a typewriter and let him type away, he's going to arrange the letters at random with no order at all. He's just a dumb thing. He can't arrange letters in any order. Well, chemistry and physics, they're just dumb things too. And they have no ability to arrange amino acids in any order at all, or any nucleotides in any order. And so, chemically and physically, by known physical and chemical processes, then, you could only get random arrangements of these compounds. Furthermore, if you had to use such random processes, the time required to put 50 or 100 of these things in a precise order, just by a random process, the time required would far exceed the 3 billion years or 5 billion years supposedly that was available. Even one molecule, to arrange one molecule of 100 amino acids by a random process, by just a chemical process, to arrange 100 of these things in a precise order to get the biological activity required actually would require billions of times longer than billions of years. There is no possibility then that these highly ordered compounds could have arisen spontaneously, not in the time postulated for the age of the earth. And even if we had the ocean swarming with these complex molecules, there is not the slightest possibility, even under those conditions, that life would arise. because all of these complex molecules must have become arranged in highly ordered systems, coordinated in time and space before life could have originated. And such order would never arise spontaneously. If you had any order present, it would spontaneously deteriorate under forces present in nature. But there's not the slightest tendency present for any such systems to arise spontaneously. Even if you had an ocean swarming with these complex molecules, there'd be not the slightest tendency for ordered systems to arise spontaneously. So as we go up the ladder in the so-called origin of life, we find that the problems multiply exponentially. And at each point, we could say this step would have been impossible. We therefore conclude, by any mechanistic, naturalistic process, the origin of life would have been simply impossible. All right, now we're going to go back to this. We had to cut it off too hurriedly for the tape. Let's go back to the arrangement of this precise order. Let's consider the probability factors involved. You know, some people say, well, after all, we had billions of years. There'd be no, you know, anything will happen in 3 billion years or 5 billion years. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there are many things that will not happen in 5 billion years. And this is one of them. Let me give you an idea of the probability factors involved. The trouble with biologists and most biochemists is they have no idea of the probability factors involved. George Wall, for example, speculating the origin of life. He says, well, after all, we had billions of years, you know, and time was the hero. Time was the hero of the plot. Listen, time could not be the hero, because the longer you wait, the more certain you are to be at the probable state. And the probable state is always the random state. The longer you wait, the worse off you are in this game. And so the longer time you have, that would not help at all. Now, let me give you an idea of some of the probability factors involved. Now, most proteins consist of hundreds of amino acids. Human growth hormone, 188 amino acids. The RNA molecule consists of 124 amino acids. Some of the other amino acids consist of several units of 500 or more amino acids combined in this absolute precise sequence. But now let's think of something simpler. Let's think of something that has only 17 amino acids. I like to use this. I happen to be familiar with the mathematics involved. Well, let's illustrate it this way. Suppose that I ask 17 of you people to line up here in a certain order. Then I want you to go out that door, come back in the auditorium, line yourselves up again in a different order. Go out that door, come back in, rearrange yourself again, and keep going out that door time after time, so that you never go out that door twice in the same order. How many times do you suppose 17 people could go out that door without going out that door twice in the same order? Now, just 17. That's all. Not hundreds. Just 17. Would you say a few hundred? Maybe a few thousand? Would some of you be bold enough, perhaps even a few million times? Do you suppose 17 people got that door a few million times without repeating their order? Well, as a matter of fact, 17 people go out that door over 355 trillion times without ever going out that door twice in the same order. You don't believe me? All right, you get 16 of your friends together after the lecture today and have you try it. You find the simpler solution is go to the computer. It happens to be 17 factorial, which is somewhere between 355 and 356 trillion. That's how many different ways you could arrange 17 different amino acids, assuming that you had only one of each amino acid. Now, if you could have repeats of amino acids, as you do in protein, and if you could choose from many more than 17, the number of possible arrangements is much, much in excess of that. But that's too simple, really. Well, even if it did happen, you'd only get one molecule. The problem is you need billions of tons of each molecule, and you need many different kinds of molecules. And furthermore, 17 is far too simple. You need protein molecules and DNA and RNA molecules with hundreds of these subunits. What about 100 amino acids? How many different ways could you arrange 100 amino acids? Say that you're choosing from 20 different kinds of amino acids, and on the primitive ocean, you'd have to choose from any more than 20. The 20 that we find in proteins, well, that's just a fraction of all the possible amino acids. How we just happen to end up with 20, no one knows. But you would choose from many more than 20. But suppose that you could just choose from 20, but you had to arrange 100 in precise order. Now, it wouldn't make any difference whether you had to put them all together instantaneously or whether you could go step by step. The probability is the same. The first amino acid had to select somehow combined with precisely the second amino acid, and you have one from 20. You'd have to choose from 20. Somehow you had to choose the right one, so you'd have one chance out of 20 of getting the correct sequence. Now, when you go to the third amino acid, you have, again, one chance out of 20 of getting the correct one. So if you're going to choose 20, you're going to have 100 of these, you'd have one chance out of 20 multiplied 100 times. The probability comes out 1 out of 10 to the 130th power that you'd end up with the precise sequence required. How big is that number? Well, let's illustrate it this way. Suppose I'm going to give a typewriter to a monkey, and I'm going to have this monkey type 100 letters every second for 5 billion years. Now I have chosen a particular sentence which has 100 letters in it, 20 different letters. We've only used 20 letters out of the 26 letters of the alphabet in constructing the sentence. We have this one sentence. Now I say, this is the sentence I want. No other order will work. This is the sentence I want. Now I'm going to give this monkey the typer and let him type away one sentence every second for 5 billion years. What is the probability that this monkey, by such a process, would produce precisely this sentence without any spelling errors in 5 billion years? Well, the chances are absolutely nil. It goes beyond that. Instead of one monkey, let's take the Earth. No, let's don't take the Earth. Let's take a billion planets the size of the Earth. 1 billion planets the size of the Earth. Now, we're going to cover every one of these planets eyeball to eyeball and elbow to elbow with monkeys. Give each one a typewriter. I figure that's about 10 square feet. So we're going to cover every one of these billion planets with monkeys. And we're going to allow each one of these monkeys to type one sentence every second for 5 billion years. What is the probability that one of these monkeys would have typed precisely this sentence with no spelling errors? Again, the answer is absolutely nil. It is beyond what they call the impossibility threshold. The reason is that the number of possible tries turns out to be 10 to the 41st power, but the number of possible arrangements is 10 to the 130th power. And 10 to the 41st power is such a minute fraction of 10 to the 130th power that the probability could be equated to zero. The number 10 to the 41st power is so small compared to the number 10 to the 130th power that 10 to the 130th minus 10 to the 41st is essentially equal to the 10 to the 130th. You have practically subtracted nothing from that large number. That number is so large that if you would cram this entire known universe absolutely solid with electrons, so that there's no space left over, the number of electrons that you could cram in the known universe is approximately 10 to the 130th power. That's how large that number is. Now, what I'm trying to say is this, is when you take these large, complex molecules, the number of different possible ways you could arrange those subunits is so infinitely large that try to get one precise sequence by any random process, you would never succeed. But you have no other mechanism. There is no intelligence. There is no creation involved. There is no procedure. There is no mechanism. Only the laws of chemistry and physics. Physical and chemical processes can be at work. This is what the theory is saying. This is what the theory demands. And by no such process would you ever get the precise order required. You couldn't even get one molecule, let alone billions of tons of many molecules. We say on the basis of the laws of probability, then the origin of life would have been absolutely impossible. We can go far beyond that. We can say to these origin of life chemists, all right, We'll give you an ocean full of every conceivable protein molecule, every conceivable RNA and DNA molecule that you can think of, and every other molecule that you want. We'll give you an ocean full of it. In spite of that, they would not get one single living thing in billions of years. Why? It's because, you see, just having proteins and DNA and RNA will not give you a living thing. You must have a high degree of coordination in time and space. You must have cooperation between the protein and the DNA and the RNA. You must have an assembly line, in other words. You must have a product come in at one line. The product of that reaction must be passed on to the next step, which then must be passed on the next step, and so forth and so on. Energy must be brought in just at the right time in the right package. You have to have ATP or GTP or some high energy source of energy produced just at the right time, delivered at the right place. The right enzyme must be there, and the product must immediately be passed on to the next step, just like the assembly line in an automobile factory. Can you imagine just taking all the parts of an automobile, just throwing them in a great big bag and shaking them up? Would you ever get an automobile? No, you wouldn't, would you? You have to have an assembly line where every step is in proper order. Now, that's what you have in a living thing, and that's what you must have. But that is something that would never arise spontaneously. There is no mechanism, chemically or physically, for this to happen. What happens chemically and physically? You get disorder. That's what happens. Dr. Morse and others, as they discuss this matter of entropy, the tendency of all organized systems to go to a disorganized state, while on the other hand, there is no tendency for disorganized systems to become spontaneously organized. That completely contradicts this idea that out of this ocean swarming with these compounds, that somehow they spontaneously became associated into systems, which began to cooperate in such a way that you had these metabolically active systems. Absolutely essential for life. That would never happen. There's no way it can happen. The ideas that suggest this as pseudoscience is anti-scientific, you see, to suggest such ideas. And yet they are being suggested. And there's some other problems involved. You see, there are always these deteriorative processes at work, degenerative processes in nature. The thymine becomes dimerized. You form the thymine dimers. Amino-containing guanine, cytosine, and adenine. These pyrimidines and purines, which contain the amino group, they are spontaneously deaminated. The amino acids, just as glutamine and asparagine, are spontaneously deaminated. It occurs in our bodies. It occurs in all living things, which would result in the complete destruction of the living thing. But in living things, you have repair mechanisms. There are enzymes and other processes which will cleave the thymine dimers. There are other enzymes that repair the deaminated cytosine and adenine and guanine and so forth. There are other mechanisms for reamidating these amino acids. There are these repair mechanisms, all kinds of repair mechanisms. More and more of these are coming to light. These repair mechanisms are absolutely essential to living things. And yet, you see, they'd have to be there from the very beginning. But they are the products of the living thing. The living thing generates these repair mechanisms. With no repair mechanisms, the organized system rapidly deteriorates. But you could have no such repair mechanism. Of course, you'd have no repair mechanism in the beginning, and yet you had to have these repair mechanisms in the beginning. Furthermore, the only way any living thing can continue to exist, or any system, any active system, the only way any active system can continue to exist is by reproduction. Any system eventually deteriorates. Any system that's active will eventually break apart, deteriorate, and be eliminated. You and I, of course, we can't beat this either. We age, we die, and we decay to a pile of dust. The only reason the human species continue to exist is because of reproduction. And that's true of all systems. The only way any system continue to exist is by reproduction or replication. But here's the problem. the system required for reproduction or for replication is the most complex system known. It would be the last thing that could possibly evolve, and yet it had to be there from the very start. If you had some system that somehow violated everything we knew about science, and somehow formed a complex system, the destiny of that complex system would be disintegration. It might be in the next minute, it might be in the next hour, it might be in the next day. But that is its ultimate destiny. The only way it could pass on the information, the complexity found within it, is by replicating itself. But it has no ability to replicate itself. It doesn't have the mechanism available. Replication requires a tremendously complex mechanism. Energy and the precise way to duplicate compounds and so forth must be present. It'd be the last thing it could possibly evolve, and yet it had to be there from the beginning. Because if it weren't there from the beginning, the system, ultimately, in minutes, hours, or days, would break apart, emptying the contents into the primitive ocean, and that's the end of the whole thing. And so we can see then that there are just many, many reasons why, based upon known principles, scientific principles, that we can say the origin of life by any mechanistic, naturalistic process would have been absolutely impossible. There's no possible way that this very complex living thing could evolve, and it involves many complex structures in the living thing, of course. The nucleus itself, with containing thousands of genes enclosed within a membrane. That is, most living things have the nucleus enclosed within a membrane. There are many complex structures in that living thing. The mitochondria, which themselves are enclosed in membranes, and the microsomes, and the Golgi bodies, and many other complex structures. The cell itself is enclosed within a multilayered membrane, which is extremely complex, functions in a very dynamic manner. You have to have this extremely complex organization before you have a living thing. The idea that this spontaneously arose by chemical and physical processes is absolutely, totally unscientific. It violates known scientific principles. Therefore, we conclude then that the only way life could have arisen on this planet is by a supernatural process. Naturally, it could never have arisen. It would never happen. Not in billions of times longer than billions of years. Therefore, the only possible way it could have arisen is by a supernatural process, by the eternally existent God Himself, our Creator. Thank you. All right, we have about 15 minutes now for some questions. Yes.
Penicillin resistance is transferred to a bacteria by a virus, they call it plasmid, bit of information injected there.
Well, one way to inject, yes, it has been mentioned that there one way of transmitting the penicillin resistance to bacteria is by the use of viruses. Well, viruses are used as carriers of genetic information. They'll complex a virus with a piece of a gene or a gene and use this means of inserting the gene into the cell as a carrier. This is why it works. I'm not sure. It just merely there's some physical attraction, some physical chemical attraction between the virus and the gene, and the virus is able to penetrate the cell and therefore carry in this genetic information. And this means is used. Now, the problem of applying this, of course, to higher forms of life, and this has been suggested, how are you going to insert genetic material into human cells, is to use something like this. Well, when you do that, if you insert this viral material into human cell and then try to use a human cell, you could have disastrous results. It might initiate cancer. It could initiate all kinds of disastrous conditions. So the idea of trying to use a virus as a carrier for these genes or something like that, I think it's slightly improbable. But you can insert genetic material into simple bacterial cells and carry in genetic information. This is possible. And it has been done on a limited scale. Yes.
Well, what I was thinking was that perhaps this is the natural way that bacteria gain has no resistance, and that it's not a mutation of any sort, and therefore not any more fuel for the evolution.
Well, I'm not sure whether this would be possible under naturally occurring conditions. We couldn't, I suppose, absolutely bar the possibility that this could happen. Now, as far as penicillin resistance is concerned, or the resistance to antibiotics is concerned, you see, this has been suggested as a mutation which results in some favorable condition. But we want to point out, first of all, that say you start with an E. coli or Bacillus subtilis, and something like this happens, you end up with a Bacillus subtilis or an E. coli. You don't change the bacteria into another kind of a bacteria, and you're certainly not going to change a single cell organism into a multicellular organism by this process. It's a very, very minor process. And we're not sure, I'm still unconvinced that it does come by a mutation. There are these differences in bacteria, but are they due to mutations? That's the question, you see. The differences do exist. But why they exist, there is a genetic difference. But how the genetic difference arose in the first place is still, I think, debatable. But even if they did arise by mutation, you're never going to change a Bacillus subtilis into an E. coli, or you're not certainly going to change a single cell into a multicellular organism by any such change. You're going to change an existing characteristic. You're going to lose your penicillin resistance or something like that, perhaps. But you're not going to initiate the kind of changes necessary to convert a single cell organism into a multicellular organism, something of that kind. These people, what they do, they make a giant leap or an extrapolation from some very simple experiment with very limited application to the grand scheme of evolution. Yes?
Have you ever heard the argument that perhaps the order of amino acids is not a sequence of amino acids, is not an ordered arrangement, but rather a random one, which has it over the process of evolution has replicated itself?
It wasn't ordered in the first place. It was just, there were all kind of random arrangements. And then what happened from all this random arrangement? One
survived or something in the life.
Some have suggested, I think maybe what's yours. Now, the question is, are we familiar with this suggestion? Everything was randomly arranged in the first place, but somehow a few of these began to replicate themselves for some reason and were selected. Well, now, there is no, first, certainly we'd say that they were all randomly arranged in the first place. It'd have to be. Now, we didn't even mention the difference between an L amino acid and a D amino acid. And if proteins are all left-handed amino acids, what we call L amino acids, chemically you get equal quantities of L and D. How come then proteins you have all L and not none of the D? What happened to all the D? Well, nobody's ever been able to answer that question. Now, living things are very selective. They can choose the L amino acids. But non-living systems, you see, could never choose. So it's a great mystery why you end up with all the L. So certainly you'd start out, well, that's another absolutely devastating argument against Fox's idea that he's got some biological activity, some enzymatic activity. The product that he gets from heating these amino acids, he ends up with approximately equal L and D amino acids. He starts out with all L amino acids. But when you heat them at 175 degrees centigrade, you convert them to equal amounts of D and L. You racemize amino acids, and he ends up with all this L and D amino acids. Well, you take an enzyme, which is biologically active, has enzymatic activity, it's all L amino acids. You replace one L amino acid with a D amino acid, just one. Suppose you got an enzyme with 500 amino acids, all L. Replace one of the L by a D. You have absolutely no biological activity. I mean absolutely none. You completely destroy biological activity. That means there's no way that Fox could have any enzymatic activity in his product because he has all these mixtures. Well, anyhow, the idea that somehow under this conglomeration of all randomly arranged molecules, one somehow would begin to replicate itself and more efficiently than the others, and somehow would be selected is purely preposterous. First of all, there is no self-replicating molecule of any kind. No molecule replicates itself, including viruses. Including genes. DNA molecules cannot replicate themselves. They have no ability to do that because they have no source of energy. They cannot supply their building blocks. They cannot supply the energy involved. They cannot supply anything except the pattern. A DNA molecule specifies the pattern. But you must supply the building blocks, you must supply the energy, and you must supply a whole lot of other things required to replicate that DNA molecule. Now, the only place you find the mechanism, the energy source, and the building block source is in a living thing. Or you can take the living thing and move that apparatus from the living thing to a test tube. But you've got to start. You've got to have this energy supply. There's no self-replicating molecule. There is no autocatalytic molecule known. There's no molecule that enhances its own replication. Once it gets started, it will be favored over any other. There's just no such molecule known in science. No one's ever demonstrated any such thing. The idea that there was a self-replicating autocatalytic molecule in the beginning is pure, absolute, unadulterated speculation not supported by one shred of evidence. As a matter of fact, while we know about science and the way things work, we can say that there never could have been any such autocatalytic molecule. They just living or chemicals just don't have such properties. Yes, sir.
You were talking about the secretarial hunting. You gave us two figures, 10 to the something power or tries, and then the possibility.
Yes.
What were those two figures?
Yes. Can we get this up? How we do that? Okay. All right. Now, if you take 20 different kinds of enzymes, 20 different kinds of amino acids, you had to arrange 20 of them in precise order. The number of different ways that you can arrange that is 20 to the 100th power, which is 10 to the 130th power. Now, on all these, you have a billion planets, 10 to the 9th, and on each planet, you have 10 to the 16th square feet. This is the number of planets that have 10 to the 16th square feet. And 5 billion years is 10 to the 17 seconds. And you have one monkey per every 10 square feet. That's equal to 10 to the 100, that's 10 to the 41st power. See, you've got a billion planets, and you've got 10 to 16 square feet total surface on each planet, but you have to use 10 square feet for each monkey. So that's the total number of monkeys that you'd get. And 5 billion years, 10 to 17 seconds. So you multiply all that, comes out 10 to the 41st power. Now, if you take, that's the total number of possible range, but you can only try 10 to the 41st power of those. That is equal, essentially, to 10 to the 130th power. I mean, this number is so infinitesimally small compared to that number. You might, if you're not familiar with exponentials, you say, well, that looks like about a third of that. No, that's not. 10 times 10 to the 129th power is 10 to the 130th power. You see? And so, even 10 times that is still on it. 130th power. Or to look at it this way, if you take 10 to the 41st power, multiply it times a trillion, that's only 10 to the 53rd power. Multiply that times a trillion, that's only 10 to the 65th power. Times a trillion equals 10 to the 77th power. Times a trillion, times a trillion, times a trillion, times a trillion. You've got to multiply it out about seven times before you get this number. What we're saying, the total number of tries possible is so infinitesimally small compared to the total number of ranges possible. The probability of hitting precisely the one out of the 10 to 130th power that's going to work is so infinitesimally small. It would never happen in only 5 billion years. Yes?
There have been ideas of chemical evolution based on natural selection at the chemical level. Could you expound on that a little?
Yes. The question is, there has been some suggestion that there's natural selection working at the molecular level. Absolutely, totally unsupported by one shred of evidence. There's no conceivable way that you could have selection at the molecular level. You'd have to have an autocatalytic molecule which self-assembles itself, and once you get some of it formed, it now favors the replication of more of itself compared to the replication of everything else. There's no such molecule known in science. Any attempt to construct an autocatalytic molecule, self-assembling, autocatalytic autocatalytic molecule has never succeeded. As we emphasize, there is no self-assembling molecule. There's no molecule can self-assemble itself. Absolutely, no way. You have to have, to form a DNA molecule, you have to have enzymes. You have to have these marvelous organic catalysts. You have to have the high energy containing molecule. You've got to have the ATP. You've got to have the GTP. You see, ATP has a high energy bond. You have the nucleus side and a couple of these high energy bonds. And it's got energy in, built into it. You got to have the ATP and you got to have the GTP and the CTP. All these high energy compounds, the thymine, the TTP, you've got to have the energy involved in there. You've got to have the pre-existing molecule. You've got to have the subunits synthesized and prepared. You've got to have, feed all that into there. And it's got to be contained into a system. You see, if it's just scattered out through some solution, aqueous solution, what's happened? The ATP hydrolyzes, GTP hydrolyzes, CTP would hydrolyze. This would hydrolyze spontaneously, much more rapidly than you'd ever get anything formed. The idea that there's a self-replicating molecule is pure a figment of somebody's imagination. There's no such thing as that. First place, there's no self-replicating molecule. Secondly, there's no autocatalytic molecule. Once it's replicated, it enhances the replication of more of itself compared to anything else. This idea is absolutely without scientific merit.